Hi, everyone. This is Catherine Adams.
And Elizabeth Wallace. And you're listening to Binary System Podcast number 422. And tonight, we're recapping Welcome to Night Vale number 252, Paid Programming. So, we were both right and wrong when we were talking about this before the episode started. As soon as we heard the name, we said, oh, Deb the Sedge and Patch of Haze. And that was correct. We also said it's probably going to be a lot of ads. It actually wasn't. It was just one ad.
Just one ad. Deb the Sedge and Patch of Haze is shilling a librarian defense. It's called shelf defense, ha. Huh? But it's a spray that you spray on yourself so that the librarians won't eat you.
Yep. And in order to demonstrate how well this product works, who does she bring in? Of course, but the main adversary of the librarians in Night Vale, it's Tamika Flynn, who comes in via a portal, but it's a product that apparently Deb gave her called a portamento.
Which teleportamento, I think, something like that.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, and I don't know that Tamika Flynn is really down with what Deb wants to do, but she's not like, you know, shrieking at Deb like a normal human being would upon finding out that, well, Deb can't test this particular spray on defense. One, because she's a patch of haze, so I don't think any kind of spray on thing would actually work. But two, sentient patches of haze apparently have a symbiotic relationship with librarians. Like, the librarians get the humidity they need from the haze, and I think the sentient patches of haze get lots and lots of money from the librarians, which they can then use to distract people so the librarians can eat them. And I really feel like Tamika's kind of got a problem with that, but she's still going with it.
Yeah, though she does portal out because she says she has kind of like a possible substitution for her going in to test this on the librarians. So Tamika portals out, and then she portals right back in, and who does she have with her but the library tweens?
Yay! Which, apparently, they have learned all their fighting skills from anime, so I would like to see that, because apparently it looks kind of jumpy and slow-mo at random places, and sometimes they're charging into battle, and you get those lines going past them like you do when anime gets really dramatic. But Deb is watching all this go down, and she's talking about, I don't know, she's just musing about money and the fact that she really likes getting lots of money from all the stuff that she shills, but she's a patch of haze, so she doesn't really need to buy things. I mean, even if she wants to go on a vacation, she can just float along in the jet stream. But I love what she said. She said having money is great in case someone else really needs money, and then she knows that she's got all of it.
Yeah. That sounds exactly like Deb. So Tamika is watching the action happen on the camera because she went ahead and portaled the tweens right into the library. They're watching what's going on, and the librarians seem to be surrounding the kids, and Tamika's very concerned about them. She's going to portal in to save them, but she's telling Deb that Deb should maybe not like show the listeners and the viewers all the carnage that's going to happen. Maybe they need to cut away to something else.
And Deb is not really sure what that should be. And Tamika says, well, when Cecil's here and things get scary, he just takes us to the weather, which is exactly what Deb decides to do.
Yes, she does. It was Starlit Aether by Virtual QSO, and it was an instrumental.
Yay! It was all electronic. It was rather quirky. I liked one of the top comments on this episode. Someone said, I know the weather isn't put with episodes in any sort of meaningful way, but this one sounded like hold music, and I think that's hysterical.
That's hilarious. I wrote down the same damn comment. We both saw the same thing. Okay, so we come back from the weather, and the good news is Tamika did manage to teleport to the library. The bad news is the cameras stopped working.
And also, I think Deb was a little worried because these teleporters that she's been selling sometimes have a habit of not teleporting all of a person. So fortunately, Tamika did entirely teleport out into the library, but she can't see what's happening until Tamika comes back in covered in blood.
Yeah, she doesn't come in by a portal, by the way. You hear the door opening, so she's not using the portal anymore. So apparently what happened is, now the spray, the shelf defense, did appear to work in the fact that it is really rancid and the librarians didn't want to come near them. However, it didn't actually repel any of them because they were still surrounded up until the point someone came into the room. It's Professor Kip, who is actually the library tweens' professor.
And he brought two friends with him. And the library tweens and Tamika all spring into action, and the library tweens grab Harrison Kip and drag him outside, and Tamika throws the teleporter at Harrison's two friends. friends with the hope of teleporting them out, and they exploded, which is why Tamika was covered in blood.
Yeah, and Deb does not sound entirely surprised by this, and Tamika even points that out, because when Tamika was saying something about what happened, Deb's like, oh yeah, I thought that might be what would happen, and Tamika's like, why did you think that it might happen that they would explode?
And Deb doesn't really want to discuss that right now. Tamika does say that she apologized to Harrison for his friends dying like that. And Harrison was like, oh, it's okay. They weren't close friends. They were just from his place of worship, which Tamika is a little horrified. But apparently they were a part of his church that regularly volunteers to sacrifice themselves to the librarians. So it's fine.
Yeah.
Except now he has to go out and recruit more people to do actual sacrifices. And he's been using Tinder, but that well's kind of run dry.
Yeah. Okay, so obviously Tamika is pissed off at Deb for giving her this device that could possibly explode her, and she's threatening Deb with taking her to the authorities, doing something, reporting her, and Deb is talking about how much she doesn't care because she's got plenty of power and plenty of money to deal with it.
And she could just go ahead and buy every judge in this county a steak dinner, and Tamika says bribery is illegal, and Deb, the sentient patch of haze, starts to laugh. And she keeps on laughing. And Elizabeth and I were comparing notes afterwards. We both wrote down that she laughed for a solid 2 minutes. It was like 45 seconds, but it feels a lot longer because, I mean, the voice actress is just throwing herself into this laugh.
It just goes on for so long. You're just so uncomfortable going, oh my God. But it does fade out towards the end. And that's when Tamika says that Deb seems to have left and, you know, stay tuned for me trying to figure out how to turn this broadcast off. She starts hitting buttons and it makes different noises, including Cecil's pre-recorded announcement in case of an apocalypse.
Yeah, about the new alien overlords, which it's a very specific apocalypse that he's got a recording for.
Yeah, but she does finally hit the next one, which abruptly takes us to the closing music. So it was just one product, and I think it's another one of those really good standalone episodes. It's good to know who Tamika is and who Deb the Sedge and Patch of Haze is and who Harrison Kipp is, I suppose. But for the most part, if you don't know anything about Night Vale, it's just a really fun, goofy, and kind of disturbing episode.
Kind of disturbing, yeah. And I guess maybe Cecil will be back from vacation next episode, which is actually going to drop in like a few days as of time of this recording. So
Yeah. We're
probably going to do two episodes in a row this month.
Yeah, well, since we're not going back and forth between this and Lore Olympus.
Still in mourning. Yes, I'm still following the Lore Olympians and Rachel's Instagram feed, so I'm still getting the occasional Lore Olympus content, just not new content.
I guess that's fine, but anyway, so that's it for Night Vale this week. I had this weird week where I was just catching up on a lot of random stuff. So first of all, we'll talk about what both of us catched up on. We watched the final episode of Poker Face.
Yes, and it starts with a storytelling trope that I absolutely love. We back up to the first episode and we see that call where Charlie got threatened by her old boss, Mr. Sterling, that he was going to chase her to the ends of the earth. But we see it from Sterling's point of view, and it's Ron Perlman, which is
Ron Perlman.
Just so freaking perfect. And he really sells it that he is going to make Charlie so miserable as he chases her down that she will actually be grateful when he finally puts an end to her. So, but then he tells Benjamin Bratt's character, I think his name is Cliff, he says, this is your job now. You are going to find her and you're going to call me. And when you do, the only thing you're going to say is to ask how deep to dig the hole. So we start day one, and it's, you see Cliff from the car saying, well, that was fast. We got a ping on her card and we're going to get her. We've got her already. And then day two is him in the convenience store, where the convenience store worker deliberately told him the wrong place where Charlie was heading to. So he's on the phone saying, we've got her. She's going to LA. And then like day five, and he's like eating something and leaning on his car shouting, what do you mean Texas? And then he just keeps going.
He has just been so demoralized, just chasing her all over, never getting anywhere close. And he is so triumphant when he realizes, you know, that the person that they said got killed in the next to last episode, he sees the body and he realizes that's not her. He says, tell me more about this Jane Doe who ended up in the hospital. He's outside of the hospital and he tells the Ron Perlman's character, He says, we got her. She's in the hospital. Just tell me how deep you want me to dig the hole. And Ron Perlman's character is like, good, stay there. Wait until she's all better, then come and bring her back to me. And Cliff is just appalled. It's like, I mean, because she's basically helpless in there. He could go and kill her or take her out right now. And for some reason, his boss is like, nope, just wait until she gets better. And you see Cliff trying to say that there's no fucking way he's going to do that. And then you see him in a hotel room, just drowning his sorrows in fast food. And he's so angry.
Yep. This has been a terrible experience for him. But meanwhile, Charlie spends 2 months in the hospital, and it seems like she had a great time, because as she's checking herself out, she's just like chatting to the different patients that she's made friends with and saying hi to the nurses and everything. And she goes to check out and she asks, how are they going to do the bill? Like, can she do a payment plan? And he says, your bill's already been paid up. And she's like, really? And he said, you've been here for 2 months in your own room that has a television. How did you think all of this works? And I think that just, you see later on in, like, towards the end of the episode, Charlie accepts good things happen to her as people just being nice. And so sometimes she really doesn't seem to know how the world works.
Nope. She realizes very quickly, because she walks outside and Cliff is waiting for her. And he says, you know, basically in the car or in the trunk. And then you see them driving away and she's obviously in the trunk, and you hear her pounding on the thing. Basically, she's like, all right, fine, I give up, whatever.
So yeah, he transports her back, and at one point she actually asks him about killing her friend, and he tells her to open up the glove compartment and take out the gun that's there. And she takes it out and she points it at him, and she's ready to fire, but she can't do it. And I guess that's just Charlie. She's just not, I mean, he even pulled over so that she wouldn't be shooting someone as they're driving, but she couldn't do it. So he just takes the gun back and chucks it in the little side pocket of the car. So they go to meet Mr. Sterling.
Yep. And before they do, you know, he has her, I don't know, he puts her in a room. And I've heard this is a trope before, when the woman is going to be taken to a terrible situation. First, she's forced to change into a really sexy outfit. And that's exactly what happens. She's wearing this very sparkly floral thing. And she goes in to talk to Ron Perlman's character, and he is not anything. And once again, this show just subverts all your expectations. He's not anything like I expected. He talks to her very pleasantly, and he's not angry at her.
Nope. He knows why she did what she did. He knows she didn't kill his son. He figures what she did to, like, you know, turn in the guy who, you know, I mean, Cliff had murdered her friend because protecting a sleazebag who had child porn on his computer was important so they could get his money, and it was more important than her life. And Ron Perlman understands what Charlie did and says, if I was in your situation, I probably would have done the same thing.
So he tells her the reason why he brought her there is, I mean, when you get down to it, it's very similar to what his son was doing. He's going to be having a meeting with one of the big families, I guess, and he's got to make sure that they're not going to get screwed over. Basically, he's perfectly willing to keep her alive because he needs to use her talents.
And she was like, if I say no, what happens? And he said, you can just walk out of here. And before he even finishes speaking, she gets up and walks away. And you can see Cliff is just fuming. And Ron Perlman just sits there for a little while. And then you hear Charlie come walking back in and sits down. So it's like $500,000. And when that's done, she can take the money and leave. She just, all she needs to do is this one thing. And I think she says, okay, she's going to do it. So he gives her a present, and it's a box with a ribbon. Open it up, lots of packing peanuts in it. And she reaches in and she looks a little surprised, and she pulls out a gun. And Ron Perlman's character looks surprised too. And the lights go out and a gun fires. And then next thing you know, Ron Perlman's character is dead with a bullet through his head.
Oh man, he is so, it's just, talk about stunt casting, man. I mean, he is there and that's it. He's really dead.
He is dead.
Gone from the episode.
I was wondering for a second if this was a dream, like she was imagining, like, actually killing him in, you know, because she was so mad at him about the fact that she'd spent an entire year knowing that she was going to die if he caught her. And she says, well, what the fuck have we been doing this last year? And he said, I was chasing you. Why? Because you were running. I was running because you were chasing me.
But none of that matters now because he is very dead. She runs and Cliff starts to yell about how she's killed him. And we see instantly that Cliff immediately grabs the gun that she had because she, of course, drops it. He grabs that and he puts down the gun that was in his hand, which is the same gun that he had had her pick up in the car, obviously. So it has all of her fingerprints on it. And it was definitely the one that shot the bad guy because he shot the bad guy and he puts it down there. So it's a complete setup.
It's a complete setup. And we see a flashback to Cliff talking with the head of the family that Ron Perlman's character was trying to work something out with so that she wouldn't try to take control. And he basically sells out his boss because he's like, you know, this whole long soliloquy about working relationships and like, basically, you know, you can go one of two ways. You either love and are completely loyal to the person or you hate them. And he hates them. He can't stand any of this. So he just, I want a yacht in addition to everything else you promised. So yeah, and he figured out pretty quickly he could set Charlie up and it's like two birds with one stone. He gets her out of his hair. He gets rid of his boss and he gets a lot of money for it.
Okay, so Charlie's obviously on the run and then she ends up in a hotel room and we don't find out right away. I was thinking for a minute, I was like, did she go back to her hotel room? They're going to look for her there. No, she did not go back to her hotel room. She went to a different one and she made a phone call.
She calls that FBI agent, I think, wasn't it?
I think it was, yeah.
The guy who was like protecting that one witness that he totally failed to protect. But he is there because of the murder of Ron Perlman's character. And he's leading the investigation because he followed up on those emails that Charlie had sent to like everybody about that sleazebag client with the child porn. And he was able to like nail this guy. So he got promoted and he's very grateful, but he doesn't know how to get Charlie out of this because if she turns herself in, he can't promise that she's not going to get taken out by somebody. And it all looks like she did it, even though he's pretty sure she didn't because she's saying she didn't. But he just tells her she has to get out. So she manages to get out by glomming onto this bachelorette party of drunk women dancing past. And she ends up in the bachelorette party in this like gigantic standing limo sort of thing with this drunk girl who's crying about how she lost it. She lost the garden she was supposed to protect. And she gives Charlie like this talisman will guide you where you need to go. And it's like a penis ring, a glowing blacklight penis ring. And Charlie's like, I gotta get out of here. And she leans to her, drink some water, okay?
It's so wholesome. It's very, very sweet. And she does get the bus to drop her off.
Yeah. And she crawls through the underbrush, runs up to a house that has police officers standing by it, but she crawls underneath the crawl space. And then you flash the inside and this little girl tells her mother, there's a woman in the yard. She's crawling under the house. I think she's going in the secret way. And the woman is just like, oh, she knows exactly what's happening here.
Yeah. So Charlie comes through the secret entranceway and everything. And there's a woman waiting for her, and it's her sister. And her sister is so pissed. And I'll tell you right now, we don't find out in this episode exactly why she's angry, though we do know it has something to do with their dad.
Yeah, because it's something like, you know, I don't know. Charlie's come here to get the keys to their father's boat so that they can she can escape. And the sister's like, oh, God. And she gives it to her. And Charlie says, you know, goodbye to the little girl who she only met one time, like right after she was born. So obviously there's been a long estrangement here. And she tries to tell her sister that she'd love to catch up. And her sister's like, no, there's a world where we would talk about this, where we would talk about what you did and what you ruined and about dad. So I'm wondering, like, did she catch her father in a horrible lie? Did she catch her sister's husband in a horrible lie? Because it doesn't seem to be a husband anywhere around there.
Right.
But we don't know if that's just because he's not there right then. But she's just mad that Charlie is like, you know, she's got police officers waiting, thinking that Charlie's going to come in, which she did. And she's talking about the fact that, you know, you just flit all over the place. And I'm sure people love you. And I'm sure you are really, really good for people. And maybe that's okay. But her sister is just like done. And I want to know what the backstory is, because it does sound like it has something to do with Charlie's ability to tell when people are lying.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So long story short, Charlie does get to the boat, her dad's boat, and it has a giant hole in it. So it's really not going to help. Now, who does she call next? Through all that this is happening, I didn't realize at no time did Cliff ever like clue her into the fact of what he was doing. She still thinks that he might be on her side. So she calls Cliff because she thinks that he's being, you know, that she's being set up and that he's being misled as well, not knowing that he's responsible.
Yep. So he tells her where he is, that he's at the marina, and then he calls the mob boss and lets her know that Charlie's on the way. And I think he also might call the police or whatever to come in. And then Charlie just shows up, like, surprisingly, because it was the same marina, because of course it was the same marina.
Sure.
So well, she's talking with Cliff and she's trying to figure out what she remembers from the shooting. And one thing she remembers is that there was a glowing point of light by Ron Perlman's character right before the shot. And Cliff figures out that it might be like a poker chip that glows in the dark because some casinos do that. And the whole time he's having to be so careful because he can't lie. So he's admitting stuff that he knows, but not the fact that he set it up. So of course, Charlie goes downstairs to grab something when he asks her for like his phone or something. And she uncovers the packet of glow in the dark poker chips. So, yeah. Which is what he had used to draw a bead on Ron Perlman's character in the dark to shoot him.
And I have to admit, this is the one part of the episode that I wasn't entirely happy with because I wanted the solution to come from her ability to tell when someone's lying, not him sending her downstairs to pick something up and her looking around and stumbling across the very thing that he was talking about 30 seconds before. I'm like, little convenient on that one, but whatever, fine.
Whatever. So she hears the sound of police arriving around about when the door gets slammed in her face. Well, she manages to pick the lock and Cliff's standing there and they get into a tussle and he's like knocking her down. She's still got that stupid penis ring on her hand, stuck on her hand, which like she takes it, she loses it at one point and then puts it back on and then it gets stuck again. So it's just like meant to be, but she sees it there and she punches him in the eye. And I think she actually puts out that eye because there's blood.
Oh, yeah. And somebody even asks him when they see him, they're like, are you okay? He's like, no, I'm not okay. I mean, he looks really bad. But she gets to the end of the boat and she actually, there had been a bit when she was talking to her niece about their dad, about how he would take them out in the boat and then make them swim to shore, even though she didn't want to. So obviously it was a very complicated relationship, but you know, she jumps in the water and she is perfectly capable of swimming because she's done it before.
Well, okay, the sirens pull up and it's not the police, it's the FBI. And he's trying to tell them about Charlie and that she's swimming away and they need to catch her. But they happen to have the tape recording that Ron Perlman's character had played early on to show Charlie that he had evidence that his son was planning on working with his enemies. But it also had the recording about what his son had said to Cliff, telling him to go ahead and kill Charlie's friend. So the FBI are arresting him. I'm like, oh my God, the final episode of the season wraps up the mystery of the first murder in the entire series. So yeah,
that was great. So brilliant.
And so Charlie's fine now. I mean, so she goes to meet the FBI agent in a diner and he's like telling her that they've actually cleared her because Cliff decided to turn state's evidence on everything and admitted that he had killed Ron Perlman's character. And he was like, why did you think I wasn't arresting you? And she was like, because we're friends. But there is something going on with that agent, because when he was telling her about the fact that they had arrested the sleazebag rich guy with child porn on his laptop, and she was so relieved. She's like, oh my God, I didn't see that in the news. And he said, no, you didn't. And then it goes right back to her. And I'm like, oh, that felt deliberate. Like something's going on there.
Yeah, maybe. Except, I don't know. It could. I mean, that guy was obviously like super rich, super powerful. I sort of wrote it off as just like, yeah, when anything happens to people who are that big and high up and everything, they're never going to be in the news.
No, that's true. That's very true. So Charlie turns down a job offer at the FBI and she walks outside and on this new, brand new phone that she's finally able to use because she's no longer in hiding, she gets a call and it's from the mob boss. And the mob boss is really upset and she's there with all of the families because there's war now and they're going to have to deal with that. And it's all because Charlie wouldn't knuckle under and play the patsy like she was supposed to for the murder of Ron Perlman's character. So now she is going to be on the run, unless if she decides to work with the mob boss and turn that weird little power that she has for telling when people are lying to their benefit, then they will let her live. And Charlie turns him down and hangs up and then smashes the phone.
Yep. So basically, if we do get a season two, which I hope we get a season two, I don't believe it's confirmed at this point, but if we get a season two, once again, it's Charlie on the run, and hopefully we can get another series of like little standalone episodes that all build to a final resolution like this one did, which is really, really impressive.
I did wonder if they were ever going to address something. Some of the murders happened in this season because of Charlie. I mean, not like she caused them and not like there were good people that decided to do something bad, but it felt like she put things in motion that ended up with the murders happening. Like the guy who ran the barbecue thing, she loans him a bunch of cute animal movies, which makes him decide that he's going to be a vegetarian and completely throw the barbecue business away. And then he gets murdered by his wife and his business partner. And then she tells that poor guy who was the drummer for that metal band that he needed to try to reach out to his bandmates and share what he could do with songwriting. And because of that, they liked his song and they murdered him for it. So it felt like that kept happening. And I don't know. I honestly expected somebody to address that before the end of the season.
I did, but there were other times when it didn't have anything to do with her. Like you've got the kid who was in the body shop and he murdered the kid from Subway who won the lottery ticket. That happened even, I think, almost before she'd even been in town. And then, what was the other one?
The theater murders, I think. That was a plan in place for a while.
Yeah, that had been. And then also you've got the two people who had been part of the cult sort of organization in the 60s who were going to murder a bunch of school kids. Yeah, those people, they'd been doing their thing for a while at that point. So yeah. I don't know, maybe half and half she had something to do with it. And the other half not.
Yeah. And it was never her causing it. Cause I get the idea that barbecue murder, that sounded like something that had been like put in place like much earlier. I have a hard time imagining that his wife just decided to go along with the sleazy business partner on the spur of the moment because her husband had decided he's going to be a vegetarian now.
No, they had that going for a while, but so yeah, really, really good. Very, very super glad I watched all of that.
Yes. It was so fun. I'm looking forward to the second season because I feel like Russian Doll, I didn't want to watch another season of that because I thought the arc was so perfect in the first season and I loved how they wrapped it up. But that's more of the same. I'm okay with that.
Yep. Totally. As long as the showrunner's the same, it's just whenever they change the showrunners, you start to be like, I don't know. Is it going to be as good? Because a lot of times it's not.
Because Hannah shared that article with us that they're thinking about a fourth season of Ted Lasso, but it might be different showrunners.
Yeah, different showrunners, different actors too, following different characters. Like Sudeikis might not come back for it. I'm like, I'm less enthusiastic about that.
Yeah.
So the only other thing I wanted to talk about is I was pet sitting this weekend, and also I had been hanging out with my friend Wade the other weekend. So between the two of those things, I have watched 3 episodes of the final season of Umbrella Academy.
Oh, wow. And?
Yeah. Now, so far, I'm enjoying a lot of it. It's fun. It's interesting. I think there's only 2 things I don't like. One, I feel like there's some scenes where the Netflix bloat is really obvious. The scenes are important, but they're going on too long. And there's only 6 episodes in the final season. So I don't know what was the, maybe they were just, I don't know, they just didn't feel like they had enough content, but needed a tighter edit in a lot of places, especially the scenes where everybody's arguing with each other. I'm like, we get it. None of them get along. Let's just go to the next thing, please. And the only other thing I don't like, and Wade, I remember now, Wade even warned me about this. In the second episode, they're in the van. In case you're a person who worries about this kind of thing, they're in a van, all of them together. There is a barfing scene that hurt my friggin' feelings. It just goes on so long. Full visual, full audio and everything. After the first couple seconds, I closed my eyes and just tried to like not, you know, look at the screen, just trying to, but the sounds and everything. And it just goes on for friggin' ever. So
I hate that.
It's just not necessary, you guys. Oh my God.
I don't understand. I guess a lot of people think it's funny is the problem.
That's exactly what it is. I'm sure a lot of people think it's hilarious. I personally am just like, man, you guys lost so many points with me on that one. But However, the story is interesting. It's going into an interesting place. I don't know. We're a little worried because you had found an article that said that people weren't entirely happy how it wrapped up.
Except it could be one of those clickbaity articles where they just, you know, glommed on some of the negative stuff that some people were saying and tried to put it as like everybody's mad about it. I have no idea.
Who knows? Who knows? Oh my goodness. But anyway, yeah, I'm going to watch the rest of it, obviously. But yeah, I was glad I finally caught up with a little of that.
Well, I am going to watch some more of Mayor of Kingstown. However,
yeah,
I cannot buy the individual episodes on Amazon because season 3 is behind the Paramount paywall, which I think is ridiculous. It's like, just take my friggin' money. Do not make me sign up for yet another streaming service, please.
Yeah, if you do decide to sign up for it, I want to say it's like $5.99 a month. So, you know, if you're worried about like the cost per episode, if you want to do it for just 1 month, I don't know. But yeah, no, I agree with you.
It would definitely be worth it. It's just the whole, I shouldn't have to.
No, it's the principle, I think. But I guess that's going to wrap us up for the week. So make sure to check out pixelatedgeek.com for all the book reviews, the movie reviews, the comic book reviews, the photo galleries. I don't have a comic book review up yet. However, I just read both The Sacrificers, the latest issue of Saga, and as of time of this recording, the next issue of Saga is coming out yesterday. Time is weird. So I might have to do like a big comic book roundup and everything, because there's a lot of stuff coming out all at once.
Yeah, I read the latest issue of Saga, and things be happening. Yeah.
Oh my goodness. And also, The Nice House by the Sea, the first issue came out, the sequel to The Nice House on the Lake. Yes, it is a sequel to The Nice House on the Lake. It is just a whole bunch of different people. But as soon as you get into it, you're like, oh, yeah, this isn't like a reboot. This isn't just like a part in a same, I don't know, the same world and everything. No, it's a sequel. And you'll find out why.
Oh, good. Yes, because I sure love that first one. God, that whole that graphic novel is worth the money, I think.
Yeah, very much so. Anyway, all that and more, pixelatedgeek.com. So next week, not like we usually do. Normally we would do Night Vale 1 week and then something else the next week. We've got another episode of Night Vale to recap. So next week, we're going to be recapping Night Vale.
Yep. I'm back from vacation and so is Cecil, hopefully.
Yay. Yay. So anyway, one way or the other, we will talk to everybody in 1 week.
Talk to y'all later.
So 1 second. So I know she was in the hotel room. Did she call her sister from the hotel
room? No, she called the FBI agent.
Oh, that's right. You may have to do this one. I'll say that we next see her and she's in a hotel room.
Yep.
So, yeah. You're going to have to help me out. I don't remember what came after that.
Charlie manages to get to the boat and there's a hole.
And then after that?
And then she calls Cliff because she thinks Cliff is with her and being set up for this.
Oh, okay. I don't remember what happened.
Okay. She goes to meet... Sorry, I think I just ripped my earplugs out.